Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
At the just-concluded United Nations COP28 climate conference, there were about 200 nations represented, and while the time did not allow the conference to issue a final message or text for the entire meeting, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack says 152 nations did sign onto a special declaration.
A declaration that outlines the steps that need to be taken in order to ensure that we can produce the food necessary to meet the nutrition needs of the world now and in the future.
And do it in a sustainable way.
It lays out a series of commitments and directions that I think are very, very consistent with what the United States farmers and ranchers have been engaged in.
Namely, participating at record levels in market-based voluntary conservation programs. Gary Crawford, Washington.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
In 2017, I did the Weather Act. It was the first major authorization bill on all of the weather programs in 20 years.
Former chairman of the House Ag Committee, now chairman of the Science, Space, and Technology Committee, Frank Lucas from Oklahoma.
It's now been 5 years since, and it's time to reauthorize the Weather Act. The goal of it is to make sure that NOAA and the National Weather Service have the necessary tools to more accurately predict the weather, both short-term, intermediate, and long-term, so that will enable us, not just Aggies, but folks in the energy business, everybody in their day-to-day life, to know what's going to happen, not just tomorrow morning. Is it going to freeze? Is it not? What kind of rainfall patterns are we going to have for the next 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, or projections as far out as we can go? Because weather determines how we farm. It determines how much energy we consume. It determines the quality of life as we're driving to and from work. Now, the Weather Act builds off of the 2017 legislation by modifying and trying to modernize critical research programs that were authorized in the first act. It also codifies several new programs that deal with weather forecasting, modeling, and predictions. And one of the things that causes the administration to go spasmic, it encourages more public-private partnerships where NOAA utilizes information from the private sector as well as their own satellites to have more data, more models to work from, to be able to offer more services out there used by the commercial sector. And also, from weather radio on down, strengthens things like the emergency preparedness. So we have more warning time when we know something is about to happen, whether it is in 15 minutes or 30 minutes or a month from now. It's just, and the science committee that's doing this, which I chair, I've worked really hard in my tenure as vice chairman and ranking member and now chairman of the committee to try and make it function like the Ag Committee. And you know, Tony, the Ag Committee is one of those committees where we may disagree by a commodity group, we might disagree by regions, but when push comes to shove, without regard to party, we're the Ag Committee, we're doing the Farm Bill. Well, that's where we are on the Weather Act and the Science Committee. We may have different perspectives, but improving the Weather Service's ability to give us warnings is tantamount to assault. And by the way, commercial services, whether it's the TV weather person or the radio weather person, uses these resources from NOAA and the National Weather Service as a part of their predictions. So it's important to all of us.
Speaking of important, no 23 Farm Bill, a one-year extension, is that good?
Well, as you mentioned, I am an old, not just an old member of the committee, but I did the 2014 Farm Bill. It started in 2012, we worked on it in 13, got to 14, and ultimately passed it. The third generation Farm Bill, as I describe it, took 2.5 years, which in itself is flabbergasting when all you're trying to do is to make sure that we can raise enough food and fiber to meet our needs and sell into the world economy. The 18 bill was basically an extension of the 14 bill, modified with adjustments to reflect the things that had gone on in the previous 4 years. So now we're should have done the 23 Farm Bill, but because of the environment up here, the best we could do was to extend the 23 Farm Bill, the 18 Farm Bill, I should say, out to September of 23. That probably was the best tactical move, because if you've got a USDA in D.C. trying to implement the Biden administration's principles of environmental and social justice, which is bad economics, and at the same time, you have a Democrat Senate and a Republican House, the challenges are incredible to overcome. Even with a great chairman like G.T. Thompson, it's difficult to overcome.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I'm visiting with Bruce Knight, and Bruce, you're here at the ASTA Field Crop Seed Convention. You moderated one of our panels here today, and it was very interesting. This was on the Climate Smart Ag Partnerships. Maybe the first thing to do would be to just define what those are.
Well, the Department of Agriculture announced a grant program about a year and a half ago. They awarded over $3 billion to 141 different partnerships that are in various ways trying to find ways to create market value associated with climate smart agriculture. Carbon sequestration, methane avoidance, nitrous oxide reductions in the atmosphere, any way that you could find a way to connect the dollars and cents of the marketplace to farmer actions. Most of these dollars are supposed to go on the ground. It's been in process for about a year now, various projects slowly getting off the ground in 2023. I expect things to really take off now in the winter of 2024 with opportunities for farmers to sign up. In many of the Midwest states, if you're in Iowa or Illinois, you're going to have dozens of folks coming down your lane asking you to be involved in one of these projects. And it's going to be everything from cover crops to feed management and their cattle to all sorts of opportunities that encourage farmers to take a look at and find something that may make sense in their operation.
Yeah, and with ASTA, the cover crops is something that they're working on. And that's some interesting statistics about, you know, what is the percentage of farmers who are actually using cover crops. I knew it was small, but I didn't know it was quite as small as it is. But that's maybe because we've talked with a lot of farmers who are doing it. But what are some of the other things that we're hearing a whole lot about? And it's kind of got the carbon word in it. It's mm-hmm. or sequestration of and carbon markets even. Are those included in those types of work that's being done?
Yes, they are. So throughout commodity agriculture in the Midwest, a lot of opportunities are going to be out there on cover crops, which are obvious. Probably today about 8% of the acres have cover crops, so there's great opportunities for involvement. No-till, minimum till, transfer from conventional till to that is another carbon smart practice that's going to be used a lot. We're expecting new products to be coming in the market around feed additives that will be out there in very short order. So you're going to be able to add something to a cow's diet and reduce her enteric fermentation, the belching, by maybe as much as 20 to 30% without reducing milk or beef production. So there's a host of these things. Some large 20% gains, others that are 3 or 5% gain. And all of this rolls up to be climate smart agriculture. What's excited about it is, for me as a lifelong conservationist, is many times it's traditional conservation practices. It's keep something green and growing. It's keep cover on the ground, minimize tillage, the stuff we've known for a long time. But now we're going to have the resources to take it at scale. You know, instead of having programs that only allow 40 acres of cover crops, you're going to be able to do 4,000. That's a big difference in farm operation.
At ASTA's Field Crop Seed Convention, I'm Chuck Zimmerman reporting.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Madagascar is a very interesting context.
Matt Bascom's Director of Engagement and Leadership for Kansas State University's Global Collaboration on Sorghum and Millet talks about sorghum in Madagascar.
They have had a lot of climate change, and there's a need for other types of cereal grains that adapt better to some of the extremes that they're experiencing. So the maize or corn belts are areas that are under threat. And so we were asked by the U.S. Embassy to come in and do an assessment on a sorghum value chain approach in Madagascar to enhance the production of sorghum. But in Madagascar also, there's large companies on the feed side who need to kind of replace corn with sorghum because of that drought issue and higher prices for maize. And so we're looking at how to respond to that.
He also discusses how they extended their international trip to learn more about sorghum.
So we finished up our 1 week in Madagascar. We then took a team of 8 Malagasy team members up to Ethiopia. Ethiopia is the genomic center of origin for much of the sorghum that we grow here and around the world. So Ethiopia is all things sorghum, and they're in their production cycle there. So we went up for about a week, and we were at several very large research stations, seed multiplication sites. We had an excellent exchange, had 3 master's level students with us as well, and just an excellent exchange on all things sorghum and trying to get them set for this adaptation trial that we'll be doing in 6 sites in Madagascar.
So Bascom also explains the different aspects they're supporting to better sorghum in Madagascar.
We're looking for, we call it translational research that transforms lives. We're always looking for leveraging the highest level of science and technology, but really to make an impact in a smallholder farmer's life, as well as large mechanized operations, so that the entire situation in terms of nutrition at a household level, and then into that food product side, feed products for dairy and beef, and even the policy side. We're working quite closely with the Minister of Agriculture in terms of the type of taxation laws that we feel need to be addressed. It's a whole approach, but with that, we want to lift the whole value chain for the betterment of everybody.
Nat Bascom with K-State's Global Collaboration on Sorghum and Millet.
The farms and ranches at a glance report shows U.S. farming is still a family business. Betty Resnick, an American Farm Bureau Federation economist, says the report is a project of USDA's Economic Research Service and National Agricultural Statistics Service.
The America's Farms and Ranches at a Glance report is from ERS and NAS, and it describes characteristics of U.S. farms and ranches. They use data from the Agricultural Resource Management Survey, which is an annual survey of about 19,000 farms.
The report says a large number of U.S. farms are still owned by families.
One of the biggest findings is that farming continues to be a family business. 97% of all U.S. farms are family-owned, and family farms account for 90% of all farm production by value. In addition, 88% of all farms are classified as small family farms.
Resnick says the report underscores the financial conditions for U.S. farms.
It puts high-risk farms as those operating at under a 10% profit margin, and low-risk farms operate above a 25% profit margin. It's important to note that every category of farms has at least a quarter of farms classified in that category as high risk, which is why the farm safety net provided by the Farm Bill is so critical to keeping our country's farms in business during volatile times. In addition, the survey does classify farms into small farms, mid-sized, large, and classifies them by both family-owned and non-family-owned.
Chad Smith, Washington.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
So, I started out in ag banking about 45 years ago. I grew up in farming out in California.
Kurt Covington, Senior Director for Institutional Credit with Ag America.
During that period of time, I was obviously attracted to agricultural lending, started in the farm credit system, eventually moved through the Midwest to the East Coast, having been the former chief credit officer at Farmer Mac. Then temporarily retired, and 6 days later decided, probably retirement's not for me. I had done a lot of work in the past with Ag America Lending, and so I migrated from the cold winter weather of the Virginias down to the sunny, warm winters of Florida.
One issue affecting all of agriculture, high interest rates, but does it compare to the 80s?
So there's a lot of comparisons to the 80s. We had some international turmoil. We had, sizable crop inventories back then. Land values were starting to appreciate. And generally speaking, prior to the farm crisis of the 80s, farm income was okay. So there are some similarities to it. What I would say that's a little bit different today is that one of them is the farmer themselves. Many of them have gotten much better at controlling their costs, understanding their costs, and having systems in their business, accounting systems, and help in understanding the cost structure and those costs that tend to and can get out of control if not managed carefully. But the other side of this as well, which has been very interesting to me, despite these high interest rate, land values continue, for the most part, to remain elevated. And that's a complete other discussion than what we're talking about here, but it's a fascinating view of land values more recently, as the USDA described in August of this year, that land values continue to increase, but clearly at a decreasing rate.
So with all this in play, what do producers need to keep an eye on?
You know, one of the backbones of U.S. agriculture has always been the family farm. And I still think there's a lot of misconception of what quote-unquote corporate farming is and big farming is. What I will say is this, is that we at Ag America will serve the small family farm as our core. That's not to say we don't do business with larger farming operations, because we do. But we also see the need for preserving the family unit out in rural America. And for us, that has always been our primary goal. And how do you do that as a lender? Well, number one, maybe you take some chances that some other traditional lenders won't take. Maybe because there's a little too much debt on the books, or because the farming operation maybe isn't of the best economic size to be involved in the financing of that operation. Or maybe there's just been some issues in the family business that you believe as a lender can overcome. But the bigger piece of this is helping agriculture see the technology that's coming. I'm a firm believer, and I'm not sure what side of the fence I'm on this, but AI, artificial intelligence, and the agricultural lending space is going to look a lot different 5 and 10 years from now. And I honestly think the delivery of agricultural credit to rural American family farms will benefit from that.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I'm visiting with Bruce Knight, and Bruce, soil health has been a real key word, if you will, that farmers are, or companies are, being able to come out with new forms of nitrogen or whatever it might be. That seems to be a real growing area, along with biologicals as well.
Absolutely. And biological and soil health seem to be very closely linked. You know, many times these biologicals are actually triggering root growth or something in the soil that will either sequester more carbon or, more viable, would allow a plant to pull more nitrogen out of the air and for its own growth and its own use. It's really exciting ways in which we have the greening of entrepreneurship occurring right now. I mean, I see more startups doing everything from virtual fences for cows to biologicals that help the critters in the soil talk to the roots. Believe it or not, they do talk to each other, and each stimulates the other and grows more and results in greater yield in the corn. These are exciting times, and the entrepreneurship around climate smart agriculture is really exciting.
You had an audience there. What kind of questions did they pose to your panel?
They ran the full range from, what's the best way to measure, report, and verify the carbon sequestration in the soil, to, does a cover crop work in a dry state? You know, and what about the impacts on soil moisture? And it's that practicality that is so vital. One of the key things on cover crops, everybody wants to know, how many acres do they need, especially at this convention, because these guys grow seed, and they need an advance warning. And so we're trying to put as much transparency into these programs so that business platforms can adapt and be able to respond on seed availability, seed demand, each of those things.
Have they fulfilled their budget?
These climate smart projects are really just getting started, but I see it not as a continual grant program. It's been kind of a one and done, a special thing that Secretary Vilsack was able to put in place at USDA. However, I do see an opportunity coming up within the Natural Resources Conservation Service. They have something called a regional conservation partnership program that is opening the door in the same way for business, cooperatives, and farmers and NGOs in the conservation community to put in proposals about what they can do on traditional conservation as well as climate smart agriculture. That's going to open probably in January, February of next year, and it will be a large opportunity to continue to do these things. So collaborative partnerships on conservation work, and there's funding out there that's going to be available for them. For a farmer, and I know most of your listeners are farmers, this winter, take a look under the hood of these programs when folks come to you. Some of the folks are, if it sounds like it's too good to be true, it probably is, but some of them are going to be worth a look. And if, especially if, as a farmer conservationist myself, I'm always looking for the things I would like to do on my ranch that I can't afford to do myself. If I can find a partner that'll help pay for that, that's better for the environment, I want to take a look at that. And I encourage, I know every farmer and rancher is in that situation. You're going to have opportunities this winter like you've never had before as a result of these and other grant opportunities out there. Know what you want to change. Know what you want to do on your farm. When those guys come knocking, ask them, will you help me on what I want to do instead of what you may want me to do?
I'm Chuck Zimmerman reporting.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
So the 4Ds is the digital and data-driven demonstration farm. So the 4Ds is the digital and data-driven demonstration.
University of Georgia engineer Glenn Raines, who's leading a project that's looking into how climate-smart production can contribute to ag producers.
One of the overall goals is to have a working farm, primarily using precision ag tools and data management tools that are commercially available, so that we can give farmers some feedback on the costs and the benefits of using those in a real situation. So we're tracking all the inputs, all the production costs, all the outputs, and can hopefully give them that information.
He says they plan to create a diversified farm so they can have a better understanding of how things interact and create a difference in sustainability efforts.
One of the things we're doing is we're integrating livestock production in with our crop rotation. So we're trying to assess sort of that diversification to improve the production by one way we're going to be looking at is how to utilize sort of cattle, livestock waste to help reduce outside inputs of fertilizer, and then also utilizing the things like cover crops in the winter and in summer crops as well to feed the cattle. Looking at ways of increasing sort of beneficial insect populations through the cover crops, reducing reliance on outside chemicals, trying to also look at this from a sustainable system. It's not just a precision ag system.
Now, they also want to be able to show producers how different tools on their operation can actually support the effort.
You know, every farm is unique, so every solution is not the same, but we'll show this solution, you know, and how it works and how they can potentially adopt some of these practices. We also, you know, part of the economic assessment is to develop what we call enterprise budgets, which would help farmers like plug in numbers and come out with, this is what it's going to cost me. This is sort of what I expect to get out of it. So the main thing is to demonstrate to them what these things are and what benefits they would be for them if they utilize them.
The USDA says farmers who hire H-2A laborers next year will be paying higher wages, and in some cases, the increase is large. Veronica Nye, senior economist with the American Farm Bureau Federation, talks about the increasing costs of farm labor.
USDA's Farm Labor Survey told us that wage rates across the United States in all states and all regions increased in 2023. The Farm Labor Survey tells us that in 2024, farmers in 13 states will pay more than a dollar more per hour to their H-2A employees than they did this year. Farmers in 31 states will pay between 50 cents and a dollar more. Only in 6 states is the increase for next year less than 50 cents.
She says this is a very important survey for production agriculture.
USDA's Farm Labor Survey is utilized by the Department of Labor to establish the adverse effect wage rate that growers must pay H-2A workers through the temporary visa program. So these wage rates are really make or break for farmers as to whether or not the wage rates they pay out
through the H-2A program are going to be viable for their business.
Some regions of the country will see a larger increase in H-2A wage rates than others.
Wage rates went up in every region. The smallest increase was for the Corn Belt region, where we saw wage rates rise a quarter, which was a 1.4% increase. The largest percentage increase was in Hawaii. Hawaiians are going to pay $1.49 per hour more next year through the H-2A program than they did this year.
Chad Smith, Washington.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
U.S. soybean growers will likely have fewer bushels to sell this marketing year, more competition from Brazil, and will suffer the triple whammy of lower prices than last season. That pretty much sums up the situation as outlined in USDA's latest soybean supply and demand report. First, hot, dry weather in northern Brazil has caused the USDA to lower its forecast for Brazil's soybean crop by 2 million tons.
That still would be record large production.
USDA Outlook Chairman Mark Chekanowski, meanwhile, the U.S. crop will be down 3% from last year. However,
despite those tighter U.S. supplies, global supplies are increasing, and that's what's weighing on prices. That's why, even with the smaller supplies in the U.S. this year, U.S. farm prices are still expected to be down from last year.
Down by $1.30, or about 9% from last year at $12.90 a bushel. Gary Crawford, Washington.